Founded in 1991 by patients, the FSH Society is the largest grassroots network of FSHD patients, their families, and research activists. The FSH Society offers a community of support, news, and information for the millions of men, women, and children affected by FSHD worldwide. This is FSH Society Radio. Welcome all, welcome all to the show. It's the FSH Society Radio Show. I'm your host, Tim, and thanks for being here. Thanks for taking time out of your busy lives, busy schedules to put me in your ears for about an hour. And love to hear from you during this show. Posted who our featured guest was on a bunch of the social media or Facebook groups I belong with and had some good chatter going around about our guest. Depends on your point of view, I suppose. On the term good, but I think I'm excited to have him on, and it should be a good show in that regard. But thank you all for being here. You want to contact the show, you want to be part of it, please do so. The number here in the rec room studio is 949-270-5953. There's also a chat room up for you right there through Blog Talk Radio. You can do that. You can use the chat room. Nice, easy way. You can even stay anonymous that way. Some are in there right now. We welcome Sean Welch. Welcome, Sean. Thanks for being in the chat room. A guest who's staying anonymous, welcome as well. So we got two in the chat room right now already, so thank you very much. Love having you there. If you want to contact me directly, either during the show, after, chat about the show, don't want it to be on social media, so to speak, you can reach me directly at fshradiohost@gmail.com. You can follow FSH Society on Facebook, on Twitter, at FSH Society. FSHSociety.org is the website. Each show, we try to have a great featured guest on. Last month, we had two guests on simultaneously. They are a pair. We had from the book and documentary series, I'll Push You, Patrick Gray and Justin Skisuk were on. Two gentlemen I had the pleasure of meeting here in Milwaukee, as we talked a little bit about. If you missed that show, it is available there on Blog Talk Radio. And please, when this show is done, you can listen to that one as well if you'd like for your listening pleasure. It was great talking with them. I think we had a blast chatting it up, talking about their journey. And it was just a lot of fun to talk with them. We actually went over. It was like almost like an hour and 20-some minute show. It was great. I felt kind of bad because we had Jun Kinoshita in the waiting room and in the green room, so they say, waiting to possibly come in and give her news and notes last month. And well, she got bumped. I hate to say it because we ran so long. So, but this show we do plan on having Jun in at the end of the show to share some news and notes of what's going on with the FSH Society. So stay tuned for that. Tonight's featured guest is Dr. Tahsin Masafar. He is the director of the MDA-ALS Neuromuscular Center at the University of California Irvine Medical Center. That is a mouthful indeed, along with a lot of other accolades in his resume. He works in the Orange County Neurological Society as well. So we're going to welcome him in. We're going to talk a little bit about, I think, how I kind of quick phrased it, because anytime I have someone that's kind of involved in the science of all this, someone that's you know, more the front lines and kind of maybe speaking a language a lot of us may understand or maybe don't, or we've kind of forced ourselves to educate ourselves about the science of this thing called FSHD or even other muscular dystrophies. And we'll talk a little bit about that with him. But keep in mind, you know, I try to keep it entertaining. I'm not trying to be mean-spirited here. I just mean that, you know, I like to say we almost are going to talk about the life and the science, and that's kind of how I posted it out there on Facebook, because we're all people that have this, and I kind of like to get the human perspective and the human side, and I've got some good questions down for him, but also June Kinoshita of the FSH Society forwarded me some that she wanted me to kind of possibly include, and man, she's got some great ones here, so we're going to lay those out, as well as a now listener who is in the chat room. you know, posted a question already on Facebook that I'd like to share with Dr. Mostafar. So I look forward to kind of spreading all that. So that's a little bit of what's going on in this show. And you can definitely chat in right now with some questions. You can email me if you'd like. Once again, that's fshradiohost@gmail.com. There's also, I believe it's, I don't know if it's info or if it's fsh@fshsociety.org. You can channel that all through the website, but I'm not going to get direct email access to that during the show. So the first one's the best one. If you want to get right to me and you want to try to stay anonymous, I can definitely do that for you if that makes you more comfortable. If you are bold to talk about things that are going on in your world, you know, we have time even now for a couple calls if you'd like, or even after the featured guest. That number is 949-270-5953. But what I also like to do is kind of, you know, share either an observation or things that have, you know, gone on in my little world, my neck of the woods. I broadcast out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that area. And it's it's getting warmer up here, so that's a good thing. But about a couple of months ago, I kind of tweaked, and I'm using air quotes, my right knee. I was trying to exercise. God forbid I do something good for myself, right? And I just take a step, hurt it, you know, whatever, stopped doing what I was doing, tried to rest it, da-da-da-da-da. Fast forward, month later, still hurts, couple doctors, MRI happens. Turns out I got a torn meniscus, which I kind of figured. I've had a similar injury to my left knee. That was the ACL blowout, the whole thing. I knew it wasn't that dramatic, but I knew it wasn't right. So I go ahead with the surgery to repair, which just happened almost a week ago. It'll be a week ago. Yeah, it'll be a week ago Friday. And got through that fine, you know, walking relatively well, still sore. But then it got me to sit in front of him again, you know, on Monday. And it was about, you know, just that post-op follow-up, those that have had surgery, go back to the doctor, talk a little about the surgery, took pictures inside my knee and the whole thing, right? And it just led me to, you know, after the fact, you know, to think of how many of us deal with this kind of situation, and then the news, either at post-op surgeries or diagnosis and those things. So he tells me this is what, maybe I'm violating a HIPAA violation here, I don't know, I don't really care. So the doctor tells me, you know, Tim, you're kind of bow-legged, which is why your meniscus was really raw and beat up, and, you know, you kind of ruptured it, so to speak, and tore it away. So he took out the inner meniscus area there, and the other side was pretty decent, but basically I got like, what, half a meniscus going on in my knee. So he says, you know, you're going to have continual soreness. It's always going to hurt. It's never going to get better. He said, if the pain gets too unbearable over time, whatever that means, years, I guess depends on my use, you could do some cortisone shots or something like that. But if that doesn't really work, or if the pain's not better, the option two is we break your leg and we readjust your leg alignment. So hence I'm not bow-legged, and then taking the pressure off the inner knee, which sounds like something out of, you know, I don't know, like the Stone Age or something. But okay. And it made me think of that song. You know, I'm not going to go into that. Anyway, then the other option is if it still hurts and the shots still kind of work, but I buy myself some time to like my 50s, you know, late 50s, because I'm only 42, that then I'd qualify for a knee replacement. But he's not sure about that because you're still bow-legged, da-da-da-da-da. So as you can tell, the news is really good, right? Then I say to him, I look right at him, I said, or all this could just buy me enough time until my, you know, muscles in my legs waste away, and I don't need the knees anyway. And he kind of like dead stared at me because he really doesn't know what FSH is. And I said, sounds like it's like I have a lot of bad news. Just like pick which door number two or, you know, one or three or whatever. They're all bad. Just a matter of time. So this might be the best I feel. And it just made me, as I was driving back to work, try to get back into my life of whatever I was, you know, doing before I was interrupted with this knee injury, it says to me, well, you know what? I think that I just say to myself, I think a lot of people deal with this, you know? I think that a lot of people, you know, deal with the pain and these kind of diagnoses all the time. And they deal with these kind of things often. And how do they handle that? You know, how do they adjust? How do they live their life? How do they get through? And I don't know how that all works for everybody. I know, you know, for me, I try to make those things happen and try to see the positive, but it's difficult. And that kind of sense of negativity, you know, warmed over me. And I guess my point is this little monologue piece I like to do each show is that, you know, I try to say, okay, if this is a situation, you know, I'm dealing with this way, other people deal with their situations, there's something, as I've said before, in their situations. And this monologue, you know, for this month is kind of like, I kind of want to bring this question up to this doctor. How do you deal with that side of your diagnosis when you hand it to somebody? Because it is not going to be pretty news you're handing these people. In some cases, it could very well be the worst news they'll hear of their life, and you're the deliverer. You know, don't kill the messenger, granted, as they say, but it's tough to stay positive in those situations. The bedside manner I received from my doctor for my knee surgery was good, but it wasn't – I mean, I think he said poor guy about 13 times. You know, poor guy, poor guy. It's like, all righty. I know. Right. And I know that we all deal with things like that. Even if you're a caregiver, a family member, you're right there in the front lines with these people that have the diagnosis in front of them as well. And you're kind of, you know, you're right in there with it. And I know my wife is. And even though I go on a lot of these appointments myself, I don't want to drag her through that part of it necessarily if she doesn't have to. But it's just another layer of bad news. So that's part of the theme, I think, for the show for me. Is like, how do we all deal with that bad news? How do we cope with it? Is it coming on the show? For me, it is. I couldn't wait to get on and talk about that situation in my life and say, what the heck, you know? How do I take this punch, this punch to the solar plexus, you know? You know, strong abs and, you know, be strong, right? And sometimes you can't be strong. And I think some good advice I've gotten from some people, it's like, you know, you're going to have to cry it out once in a while. You have to mourn it a little bit. And I think I want that to happen. But at the same time, it's tough. Because you constantly think about, you know, is this just another thing, another bad thing to happen? So, anywho, why don't we take our first break? If you got comments on what you're going through, if it's something currently or, you know, something down the line that you know, you're kind of wrestling with, you know, send me those emails, chat room up if you'd like. Send me an email, fshradiohost@gmail.com. That's fshradiohost@gmail.com. You can get a hold of me directly. If you'd like. Why don't we take our first break of the show, as I'm hoping that the good doctor calls in right after our break and we can get our featured guest on. You're listening to the FSH Society Radio Show.
FSHD is one of the most common forms of muscular dystrophy. It's a degenerative disease that weakens muscles in the face, shoulders, upper back, and legs. FSHD robs you of your smile and makes simple tasks nearly impossible to perform. FSHD affects hundreds of thousands of people, but most have never met another patient. Many have not even been diagnosed. Someone you know may be living with FSHD. Let them know they are not alone and that we're making real advances toward a treatment. You can help by going to our website, fshsociety.org/cureFSHD. And share the photos and facts about the disease using the hashtag CureFSHD. By simply raising awareness, you could change someone's life and help us get closer to a cure.
Kelly O'Hara. here to support my good friend and consummate musician, Stephen Blyer, and the countless others who suffer from FSHD muscular dystrophy. FSHD, the most common form of muscular dystrophy, is a lifelong progressive loss of all skeletal muscles.
I have FSHD and I hope we find a cure soon so I can be stronger and faster. Give with your whole heart so they can find a cure real soon.
But now that the stars are in your eyes, I'm beginning to see the
Hey, welcome back to the FSH Society Radio Show. I'm Tim, your host of the show, and still waiting on our guest to call in, so this is the point of every radio host where you start to sweat, and that's fine. Because I have you great listeners, if you want to chime in now, I guess we can accept those calls right now. Why don't you become the guest of the show? We did that a couple shows back. It was actually pretty cool because we really had a good call-in experience. We had people dialing into the show and talking quite a bit about, you know, certain things that they were dealing with, or talk about their diagnosis story and how they've been handling it, even ways that they've been exercising or, you know, certain things that they've been using to keep themselves, you know, viable or, you know, strong as long as possible. And they were really, you know, chiming in with a lot of those things and kind of passing on a lot of information. So it really turned into this support group. So to speak, because, you know, normally at this time of the show, we would have our featured guests. And fortunately, maybe something has happened to the good doctor, Tassin Mustafar, who we were hoping would make it in. But it appears that so we have a caller in, but I don't believe that is him. So we digress and we do what we can as long as we can. And if we need to take an extra break, Then so be it. okay. Why don't we answer this caller? This actually might be him. So we're going to answer this call. Hello. Is this Dr. Tassin Mustafar?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
A couple of minutes. I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, yeah. I am doing well. Yeah, sorry, I did not recognize that number on there to be yours. So I do apologize, and it means you hold in there for too long. So I won't take up too much of your time here with massive introductions, because the guests know that you're coming on. They also know that you're part of the MDA and ALS Neuromuscular Center at the University of California, Irvine. So we're happy to have you on. And my first question for you, Doctor, is tell us about the Muscular Dystrophy Center at that University of California, Irvine. Tell us a little bit about that place.
I just want to make sure that you guys can hear me okay.
Oh, yeah. So far, so good. Sounds good.
All right. So the Neuromuscular Center and the Muscular Dystrophy Clinic at Irvine has been in existence since 2001. I joined the university in 2000, and one of the mandates that I was given by my chairman of neurology was to establish a neuromuscular center and a muscular dystrophy clinic. So we managed to convince the Muscular Dystrophy Association to give us a center designation in 2001, and we have slowly developed it into one of the busier clinics in Southern California. We see about 2,000 annual visits, about 40 FSH patients at any given time.
Wow. You said 40, 4-0?
4-0, yes, sir.
And now, so then is that about how many you see in a year? I mean, what's kind of like, is an ongoing, you're seeing about 40?
Yeah, 40 annually is what we have averaged over the last 10 to 15 years.
Wow. Have you seen that number increase over that time that you've been there?
I have not necessarily seen an increase. I mean, we have added new physicians. So the other physicians are also participating in care of these patients. So there has been some increase because of just increased capacity, but not necessarily in terms of the sheer numbers. Now, there is an interesting tidbit about that. So I was never struck by a gender difference in the FSH patients that I saw. So I had male patients, I had female patients, but my colleague, Dr. Goyal, who joined me in 2012 in Boston, somehow only saw male patients with FSH. So her practice, when she first started here, the first few years she only had, and still to this day, she predominantly has male patients with FSH. And I kept telling her that, look, I have no such issue. I have enough female patients. And then we systematically looked at our numbers. And it turns out that she was right, that females constitute about 1/3 of our total number of FSH patients. And most of them are in their 40s and 50s. In the young, if you look at younger FSH populations, it's predominantly a male population. Not to say that there aren't females that I've seen, but somehow the female patients that we see are mostly in the middle age.
So we got then a nice picture then of the type of age and gender of the patients that are coming in. But if someone is kind of, you know, they're questioning maybe what's happening with their body, if they're having difficulty smiling or one of those symptoms start to emerge, and they find their way to your clinic, what can they expect when they first come there? Take us through the diagnostic process.
Sure. So they can either come in on a day where there is other members of the team available, including a physical therapist, as well as a respiratory therapist and a social worker, or they may come on a day where we don't have the multidisciplinary team available to see patients. What is involved in a new patient visit is a thorough review of any previous medical records that they have had. We would sit down with the patient, spend a lot of time taking a detailed history, and then going through a very careful examination of the patient. Now, in somebody who has a fairly prominent FSH, it's an easy diagnosis because you can see it from a distance.
Sure.
But then we all have been fooled, and there have been cases which were very mild, and they didn't really declare themselves for another year or two. But in the first visit, we would go through a detailed history. We would go through a family history. We would examine them. And then either on that visit or in a subsequent visit, do the rest of the testing, including the blood tests as well as the electromyography or the EMG testing that is pretty routine in these patients. But most of the time, if the answer is obvious, that it looks like FSH, then we would just do a muscle enzyme, a CK value, and then we would try to just send off the genetic test. So we try to avoid the invasive testing, such as a muscle biopsy or EMG nerve conduction in this condition.
So you said that the ones that the people that come in and you can kind of see it from a distance, you know, and I understand what you mean if it's something, especially to you doctors such as yourself, where you're seeing it on a more regular basis. But how about those like primary physicians, you know, where maybe it's a little more cloaked, where it's a little more difficult to try to even see what it is? Because I know in my situation, I mean, I've been seeing doctors since I was, you know, well, forever, right? And I wasn't diagnosed till I was 41 years old. So with that all being said, it makes it interesting to me that I know some of these things were still giving me trouble, you know, lifting, strength. Why was I not diagnosed, or at least why wasn't there any red flags posted, you know, sooner? So my question is, I guess, is being a disease that's so difficult to find or to diagnose for most, and doctors, you know, the average doctor that doesn't even know what it is to begin with. What do you give advice for those people that are kind of searching, and maybe they've stumbled upon this show, or maybe it's even a doctor listening? You know, what are some of those hidden signs that maybe are a little more obvious to you, but not to them?
Sure, and I think you hit upon a very important point. So I can tell you, for instance, we run a combined myositis clinic with our rheumatologist, where they bring in their difficult cases that they thought had inflammatory myopathy, and we bring in our difficult inflammatory myopathy case. And one day they brought in a patient that our rheumatologist wanted us to see because she was suspecting that this was not an inflammatory myopathy, it was something else. And a fellow, my postgraduate fellow, went in, 5 minutes later came out and told me, this woman has FSH, the woman does not have an inflammatory myopathy. So sometimes it's that obvious, but even the most specialized physicians who are not used to seeing FSH may completely miss it. The clues that I look for when I'm looking for FSH is the facial asymmetry or the facial weakness. And the patients with FSH have a very peculiar facial weakness, which seems to be most prominent in the lower part of the face. So below the lips is where this appears to be a muscle atrophy and muscle weakness. Also scapular winging. So both scapula or one of the scapula jutting out is a very helpful clue. They also get something called an inverted axillary fold. So when you have them take off their shirt, in the armpits, they have a crease or a line that comes out into the anterior chest wall. And that's known as an inverted axillary crease. And I can tell you that Dr. Goyal, who's my colleague, diagnosed one of my long-standing patients that I didn't even suspect had FSH. I just look at the inverted axillary fold. So that helps to be a very helpful clue. And then the lordosis or the curvature of the spine when they walk is usually a very helpful sign. So a lot of FSH patients have proximal hip weakness. They have difficulty getting out of a chair. They have difficulty walking straight. And in particularly in FSH, it's a very peculiar curvature, where if you can draw a line between the scapula or the shoulder blade down to their buttocks, it would directly meet. And that is one of the clues that they have FSH. And that helps distinguish that from other muscular dystrophies.
That's fascinating. Now, there are, as far as I understand it, there's FSH1 and FSH2. Is there any dramatic difference between the two?
Clinically, there's no difference. You can't tell them apart. It's only on the basis of the blood test and the genetic testing that you can tell them apart. But on a chemical exam, if I'm seeing a patient with FSH, I cannot tell the difference between the two, which is very different from some of the other muscular dystrophies. For example, myotonic dystrophy, which is another inherited muscle disease, equal frequency in terms of number of patients in our clinics. But the type 1 are very different from type 2. Whereas in FSH, type 1 is one the predominant type anyway. So type 1 accounts for almost 90% of all FSH. But you can't tell the difference between type 1 and type 2.
Is there, I did a little homework on you. So I watched a video that you talked about, you know, the FSH, and you kind of hinted that there could be a type 3. Is that accurate?
So, probably true.
Oh, you still there, doctor?
Can you hear me? I'm still there. Sorry.
That's okay.
So there are few patients out there who have tested negative for FSH1, and they have tested negative for FSH2. And they have all the clinical features, all the features of FSH muscular dystrophy. So some of us are convinced that there is a FSH3 as well. We have not found the gene for.
Wow. Now, do you find then, even with that kind of thought process, that there could be a third, you know, gene? So there's a third type. Is this, does this, I mean, maybe I'm being a little bold by asking this question, but does this FSH, does FSH frustrate you as a doctor?
Not necessarily. I won't use the word frustration in a session. I have been guilty of calling FSH a minor muscular dystrophy, and I got chided for it by one of the patients. The reason I said that was mainly because, unlike most other muscular dystrophies, there is not a prominent respiratory involvement, often not a prominent heart involvement. So the life expectancy in FSH is not curtailed or affected as much as some of the other muscular dystrophies. I'm not trying to minimize the amount of muscle impairment or the handicap or disability. Having said that, there are patients who are very mild and very functional, and then there are childhood onset patients who are quite severely affected and quite disabled. Mm-hmm.
So then would you think, I mean, because I've heard that in my own diagnosis when it came to the term, you know, it's life shortening. It's not life threatening. So what would, I don't see a huge difference between the two terms. In your clinical opinion, what is the difference between the two? Is it basically what you're explaining already?
I would even venture out to say that it's not even life shortening. So the life expectancy in FSH is not any less than a normal individual. So whereas, let's say, if you take examples of myotonic dystrophy or Becker's muscular dystrophy, where there's a prominent cardiac and a prominent lung involvement, they don't live a full life expectancy. And almost all FSH patients, except for the very severe ones that are affected at early childhood, their life expectancy is normal for most of these individuals. So I would not necessarily say that the life is shorter in FSH.
Mm. Right. But it's definitely a life changing diagnosis for most.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
It does affect the quality of life, and it does affect the lifestyle.
So I've had this question. I've asked this on several guests and actually other fellow patients, and I'll ask the same question to you because your opinion, I think, is very important in this topic, of course. Is, do you find that patients have a harder time dealing with FSH physically or mentally, you know, emotionally or, you know, a psychological effect?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? I didn't understand.
Sure, that's fine. You know, people that have FSH, you know, there is a physical, obviously, situation that they're dealing with. But the diagnosis part of it or the mental capacity to understand that your body is going to slowly deteriorate to some degree and that you will become slowly handicapped, sometimes that has a deeper mental effect than a physical. So I just wanted to ask then, in your professional opinion, have you found it to be more of an impact on your patients physically or on their mental well-being?
Both. So, I mean, there are clearly patients who are very physically disabled, but yet able to cope with the disease. But then there are patients who have relatively milder disease, but the fatigue and some of the limitations in their day-to-day activity is definitely taking a toll on their emotions and their emotional strength. So, again, there are aspects of the disease that we don't fully understand yet. So, for instance, pain becomes a huge issue. We think that pain is mainly related to the imbalance in muscle strength. FSH is an asymmetric disease. Unlike most other muscular dystrophies and most other genetic disorders, there is the loss of strength is not equal on each side. So because of this imbalance, we think that the muscle, some muscles get overworked, some muscles get strained much more easily, and pain becomes a huge issue in some FSH patients. Fatigue, just tiredness, overall tiredness is a huge issue in some patients. So, so even though their overall muscle strength is relatively preserved and the amount of obvious physical disability may still be small, that doesn't mean that they're not suffering from some of the other issues such as fatigue and pain.
Absolutely. Do you think then that people should continue that have FSHD, should they continue to get annual checkups? Because, you know, a lot of them think, well, there's nothing that they can do for me, so why do I keep going back?
So at the same conference where you may have seen my video of making a claim about FSH3, a number of patients that came to that conference made the claim that they don't like going to muscular dystrophy clinics because nothing gets done. That we, if anything, do a horrible job of reminding them that they have a disease and how that disease has progressed, but really don't offer much, which is not true. I don't agree with that philosophy. I think the idea is you don't have to attend a clinic more often than once a year. But the idea of the clinic is to one, document what your current status is, keep an eye on your disability. So if there are things that we can do to overcome that disability, whether it in terms of adaptive devices, whether in terms of physical therapy, occupational therapy, or even sometimes hydrotherapy and other things, that can be done. But it also gives us an opportunity to, one, think about the disease process. If the genetics have not been done, we can always get the genetics done. But then it gives us an opportunity for us to discuss what's happening in the field in terms of research, and what do we know about the disease process, and where are we going in terms of clinical trials and clinical treatment.
And when it comes to, I mean, I do agree. I mean, I kind of said to my, you know, MD doctor, as I call him, Dr. Fee, I said, you know, he goes, Tim, how often do you want to come back here? Do you want to come back, you know, once a month? Do you want to come back once a year? And I said, well, you know, unless you got a cure in your desk drawer somewhere. And I said, I don't know, once a year, because I kind of have that same attitude. I'm kind of a realist. You know, someone here in the chat room said, you know, it's kind of a life limiting disease. And I kind of agree with that. It's definitely affected me mentally more than physically so far. It's put a lot of connections together why I haven't been able to do certain things like others could. And then to get the bad news of, oh, yeah, and you're not going to get any better. Oh, okay. So to me, it's kind of, I'm kind of more brash about it in that regard. But I do understand your opinion that it's good to monitor it, to log it, to track it, to kind of see where you are, to where you've been. And do you believe then that would help someone then create kind of a roadmap to where it could be a year down the road, 5 years down the road? Is there a benefit by coming to the doctor for that?
Sure. I mean, I think all of those things that you said can happen. I mean, I think the most important thing to remember is that even though we may not have a cure at this point, there are definitely treatments that are available for some of the symptoms of FSH. Mm-hmm. So it's not only important to focus on a cure, but it also can there be symptomatic treatment for some of these symptoms like fatigue, like pain, like some of the other aspects of that. And I think it gives us a sense. So if somebody, for instance, I've seen them on 3 annual visits and they have had minimal progression, then I would feel more comfortable with telling them that, look, you have a relatively non-progressive disease, or you have a milder disease, and your chances of getting significantly handicapped and disabled from it is limited. And when we say disability, we're talking about going into a wheelchair or going into a situation where you depend on other people. Okay, so I think that you can scope out the range of the disease by those visits.
Now, since we're on the subject of treatment, I know I've seen this, you know, drug mentioned in the news, I believe. And when I social media that you would be on the show, there is some chatter on Facebook, and a question kind of popped out of that chatter from someone in Orange, California, asked, what kind of treatments do you offer? Do you offer, or why don't you offer, the treatment of Spinraza, if I'm pronouncing that right?
Sure. So Spinraza was approved for spinal muscular atrophy. That's a completely different disease. And the genetic mechanism in that disease is very different. So Spinraza works specifically for that disease. It would not work in FSH muscular dystrophy.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I wanted to give that drug, it would not make sense.
Not for at least the FSHD.
True. So having said that, there are a number of investigators who are exploring the same mechanism that was used for Spinraza. So what Spinraza is a class of drug called antisense oligonucleotides. And what these are genetic materials that have been synthetically produced, and they are getting introduced into the body, and they go and silence or they alter the gene function of the target gene. So for instance, in Spinraza, in spinal muscular atrophy, is interfering with a mechanism whereby this gene gets restored to its original form. So in the genetic fault in a spinal muscular atrophy is that they are missing SMN1, and by giving them this ASO or this antisense oligonucleotide, you can now start producing SMN1 type of protein, and that fixes to some extent the disease. The similar mechanism is being explored in FSH. So the idea is that we know that FSH is caused by continuing expression of a protein called DUX4. DUX4 is something that is useful in when the fetus is developing, but it has no place in adult muscle. So it's a developmentally regulated protein or a developmentally regulated gene. And so if you know that, that means that if you shut off the gene in an adult muscle, it will have no harm. If anything, it will have benefit. So people are exploring the similar mechanism to see if they can reliably shut down the DUX4 expression in muscle. Now, there are problems with delivery. How do you deliver these chemicals to entire body? Because right now, the only way you can do it is to do it subcutaneous injection and have limited expression into the muscle. So I think a lot of the work that you will see in the next few years is fine-tuning the delivery mechanisms for some of these antisense nucleotides.
So do you believe that then there is a hope for a treatment, possibly a cure in the future or in our lifetime?
Yes. So this is an incredibly exciting time, and this is what I tell my patient. About 10 years ago, we had absolutely no idea what caused FSH. We knew that there was a deletion of a large segment of the chromosome on chromosome 4, but how did that really translate into disease? We had no clue. Just in the last 5 to 6 years, we now know what the mechanism is. We know that it's a developmentally regulated gene. All you have to do now is to find a way to shut down this protein. Okay? And I would bet you that in our lifetime, we should see a treatment for it, like we have done for spinal muscular atrophy, like we have done for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. We are getting closer to a definitive treatment for FSH.
Is there research for FSHD happening right now at UC Irvine?
Yes, we have two biochemists who spend a lot of their time looking at FSH muscular dystrophy. So Kyoko Yokomori, who's a professor in biochemistry, has spent a lot of her time in a career in looking at chromatin and what the area of biochemistry called epigenetics, which is the differential expression of genes in different muscles. Sarah Winokur was also looking at it in biochemistry.
And then Leslie Locke has done a lot of work looking at creating induced pluripotent cells that can be expressed into muscle cells from patients with FSH. So there's a lot of stem cell work that has also been going on at Irvine.
Is there a way that patients can get involved in any clinical studies or trials, if it's at your location or others, that maybe we got some volunteers out there listening?
Sure. We have an active clinical trials group. We do a lot of clinical trials in neuromuscular disease. The most important thing would be to stay in touch with our clinic, so we can inform you guys of trials when they come along in FSH. Currently, we are not part of the Acceleron study, which is going on at UCLA. I'm actually on the safety board for that drug study.
Mm-hmm.
But we participated in the ATIRE study, which is a company in Carlsbad, which did a small study in FSH muscular dystrophy. So there are other companies that are also doing study. And because we have a good reputation in clinical trials, we usually get asked to do these trials. So I would suggest that if there is a patient listening who happens to be from Orange County or surrounding county, the best thing would be to either establish themselves as a patient or at least be on our radar, which means that you contact our coordinators and let them know that they have FSH. They may be a Kaiser patient, or they may belong to a restrictive insurance that won't allow them to come to Irvine, but that doesn't mean that they can't let us know that they are in the area and they would be interested in clinical trials.
Now, I had a question that was raised. Actually, it was by my wife when we were going through my diagnosis process, because I have two young boys, and we had the kids before I was diagnosed. I wanted to ask you, from generation to generation, and I know this is a question on a lot of people's minds, is what are the effects of this FSH disease from generation to generation? Does it get worse, stay the same, or does it get better?
So, I think that the jury is still out on this one. So, if you look at the molecular mechanism, theoretically it should increase with each generation. But we see all sorts of examples. So there are clearly some families where the parent had a mild disease, and the kids had more prominent and more severe disease. But we also, within the same generation, see different diseases. So one sibling has more severe disease and the other sibling is relatively mild. So the epigenetics, which is the control of expression of genes, plays a very important role in this disease. And therefore, the inheritance is variable. So you may inherit the gene from your parents but not show the same effect. And even expression in an individual is very variable. So it's not as clean-cut as, let's say, myotonic dystrophy, where we know that each successive generation will have a earlier onset of disease and more severe disease. That we cannot say with certain percent predictability in FSH.
What would be, though, then the treatment that someone can do that has FSHD? Is it steroids right now? Is it just, I know you mentioned in that video I watched, that one in particular, you mentioned, trying to deal with the muscle inflammation. What kind of treatment plan do you offer people, or do you suggest to those that are trying to battle this now before a cure is found?
Sure. So muscle inflammation is something that is very prominent in FSH patients, especially early on in the disease. People have looked at anti-inflammatory. So there have been trials using corticosteroids and other things, and by and large, most of them didn't work. Now, there are newer forms of anti-inflammatory that are being tried in clinical trials. So I would not routinely prescribe anti-inflammatory. If I were to do anti-inflammatory, it would be predominantly through a clinical trial, not through a prescription. But there are, occasionally we will use muscle stimulants, so things like albuterol, which is an asthma drug. I would occasionally use that drug just to make the muscles grow bigger, and in some patients it gets stronger. Or anabolic steroids, such as oxandrolone, which is an FDA-approved drug. I would occasionally give that drug to somebody who really has severe atrophy or muscle weakness, just to see if I can make the muscles bigger and somewhat stronger on that. So, and creatine, which is a relatively innocuous supplement, that's something that I also recommend to my patients.
Okay. How about homeopathic options? Like, you know, like I was suggested, don't do a lot of weights. You could damage other things. Do things like yoga. People have even suggested to me, Tim, have you tried acupuncture and these other kind of things? What's your take on those kind of treatments?
So, I mean, again, I think exercise is important. I do routinely recommend swimming as a form of exercise. You just have to be careful that there is unequal amounts of strength on each side. So the same amount of exercise on one limb may not be safe on the other limb because of weakness. And the same goes for weight training. So if you're going into the gym, you have to be careful because you may have unequal weakness. The other realization is that it's a progressive disease. There's a continuous amount of muscle degeneration that's going on. So the expectation has to be realistic. You're not going to be able to go into the gym and make your muscles a whole lot stronger. So the purpose of exercise is to keep the muscles going, to prevent their atrophy. But if you're going into the gym and you say you're going to get 10 pounds stronger, that's probably not going to happen. And in the process, you might hurt yourself and you might fatigue out yourself.
Yeah, that was a nice segue, Doctor. You should be on the radio because that was just my next question was going to be what to avoid. And I think that was like spot on. Yeah, that was the advice I received as well, because before I was diagnosed, I'm not going to lie, I hit the darn gym pretty hard thinking, okay, for once and for all, before I get too old here, I want to develop some type of muscle mass. And that was a red flag for me outside of other things that, hey, I'm not getting muscle tone here. Why is that? I've done this for like a year and certain things are not responding on my body. This is odd. So I totally agree. I think it is kind of a listening to your body type thing, but I think that advice you gave about, you know, knowing what side of your body is stronger, what's weaker, goes back to that to me. You know, it's kind of listen to your body. Don't do too much. Final question for you, sir, is you have, you know, patients you probably see, you said you've had, you know, 40 annually. So they were all new patients at some time. What is your advice to patients and families who are listening that you give to them, I guess, at that point of diagnosis? You know, you're probably the bearer of the bad news that they have something and this is what it could do to you. What advice do you have for those that are dealing with that right now?
So a lot of our discussion is highlighting two major issues in the disease. One is that it's a disease, it's a progressive disease. Everyone progresses at a different rate. So it's very difficult for us to predict what the rate of progression is going to be on the first visit. And as I said, there are patients of mine who are incredibly mildly affected, and they have very little to show for the disease, and then there are patients who are quite severely affected. So there is a broad range in terms of how the disease behaves. But the second aspect that I focus on is the familial nature of the disease. So this, even if they don't have a family history, this is a dominant disease, which means that they probably inherited it from one of their parents. And if they have children, their children are potentially at risk. Now, the good news is there is a variable penetrance, which means that even if the kids inherited the gene, they may not manifest the disease fully, or they may have a milder disease phenotype than that. And it's not a life-threatening disease. This is disease does not affect the heart function. It does not affect lung functions. So compared to some of the other muscular dystrophies, it has less in terms of morbidity associated with it. And those are the two areas where I really focus. But I also tell them about how to stay active, how to exercise so they can keep the muscles active and prevent the muscles from decaying and atrophying.
Fantastic advice, doctor. Thank you for joining us today. I know you're probably a very busy man. I appreciate your time tonight and taking time out to join us and give us some great advice. We appreciate you very much. Thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
So that was Dr. Tahseen Mosafar. He it was a little touch and go there in the beginning. I'm not going to lie, folks. I thought, oh, is that him? But we got it handled. Glad he came on. I hope that you got some value out of it. Why don't we take a quick break? We come back. Hang in there. We come back because I'll have a final thought or two. I know that someone chatted another question there that I didn't get a chance to ask because we were up against the clock here. But maybe I can comment on that question myself. So hang tight. We'll take our final break. You're listening to the FSH Society Radio Show. You're listening to FSH Society Radio. Hey everyone, this is Tim, host of FSH Society Radio. And get this, in 2014, a Dutch team reported that aerobic exercise training and cognitive behavioral therapy decreased fatigue and improved the quality of life significantly for FSHD patients. This suggests a marked impact in slowing the degeneration of affected muscles. So I don't want to hear any excuses. You can get out there, get active, start exercising, and let's start fighting this thing. Hi, this is Tim again, and have you been recently diagnosed with FSHD and kind of trying to search for answers? I mean, there's so many questions. Where do you go? Well, go to fshsociety.org. Join the FSH Society. Get educated, because knowledge is power. Get active. Connect with local members. Volunteer for research and donate, because without you, we can't fight this. Go to fshsociety.org. Hey, welcome back to the show, FSH Society Radio. Thanks for being here. Thanks for staying tuned in for the hour show. Our guest today was Dr. Tahseen Mosafar, and he's a doctor out there in California, sunny California. I'm envious, okay? He's the director of the MDA-ALS Neuromuscular Center at the University of California, Irvine Medical Center. Joined us, talked a lot about, you know, how this deals with how this disease affects people's lives, how it affects people's, you know, mental, I don't want to say, you know, the mental side, I guess, of it, what it does to you physically, what it does to you mentally. We talked about that, talked about the science of it a little bit. I'm not going to lie, I'm a little selfish because I'm definitely going to say that, you know, I am kind of bored of the science of it because I'm not a scientist. I try to develop a little bit of a dialogue with those scientists and doctors that come on the show, which I'm always grateful they do, but I kind of want to get it from that, you know, patient point of view. And I think the good doctor did that fantastically today and really gave us a lot of good information. Now we had someone in the chat room, Sean, and he has been right there from the beginning, stuck through us. Hey, look like he had a technical difficulty, couldn't hear us for a second. He came back, he listened to the show. Thanks, Sean, for joining us. And he had a question. We talked about the proteins, you know, creatine, you know, whey powder, those kind of things. He said, you know, how much creatine? How about whey protein? I can tell you from experience, Sean, that, you know, for me with my disease, what I have here, there's no question it has affected my pectoral muscles. I have none. My bicep muscles are very, very thin, and I have winging in the back. So it's affected my torso, which I don't want to disagree with. This is going to be a sidebar comment here. I don't want to disagree completely with someone in the medical field as a doctor, Tassin was talking today about how it doesn't affect your lungs or your heart. All I know is that as my muscles have gotten thinner and thinner over the last couple of years, and this last year, I can feel, you know, my collarbone cleanly, you know, through my skin. There's no muscle there at all. I have a CPAP now. And normally a person like myself of weight and size wouldn't have one. I know, and my MD specialist has suggested, it could very well be a product of what I have because of where it's affecting me. So I do believe it can affect, but personally, I will, you know, disagree on my small little pedestal down there without a medical degree that I believe it's affected me in the lung capacity. But going back now off the sidebar comment to your creatine whey powder, is that when I was trying to do a lot of physical work, I was using protein, and it was whey, and it was isogenic. So there's a plug I won't get paid for. It was awesome stuff. I would still use it today if I could afford it. It's the only one I would use. Isogenics. Look it up. It tastes fantastic. It's about $35 a jug. I think it helped me in that time build more muscles in where I could build them. But in places I wanted them, I wasn't getting them. It also helps in losing weight if you need to. That's something I need to do. So I probably have to try to figure out a way to afford that stuff. They have great protein bars and all that stuff. Real easy to use. Add water, milk, whatever. Take it on the go. It's simple. It's like a meal replacement thing. Look that up. That's my advice. I suggest. I've not tried creatine. And to me, you know, I'll tell you right now that creatine, I guess I would try it, but it has to taste good. And isogenics tasted like I was literally drinking an ice cream shake. It was just borderline addicting. Anyway, maybe they got something in that powder to do that to you. It's very possible. If you want to get in contact with me, you can. fshradiohost@gmail.com. That is my direct email if you want to talk to me about this show, upcoming show, show ideas, ask me questions. You just want some support, I'm here for you. FSHSociety.org is the FSH Society's email. Follow them on Twitter at FSH Society and FSHSociety.org. They got a Facebook link. All that's there. All the news and notes. June was unable to join us today. Looks like that didn't work out. That's fine. That's fine. We'll get her next time. Because next month, I'm really kind of hoping. I'm kind of working on this next show for next month in March. I'm going to sit with some good people tomorrow on an FSH a meeting group. Via on some web meeting platform. So I'm excited to do that, getting some ideas. And I kind of want to bring that kind of idea, that platform, to the March show. A couple shows back, we did a support group style show. I'd like to do that next month. So how do we do that? I need you to call in. I need you to chat room in. I need you to send me some Facebook messages. I need you to get involved with the show. What do you want to talk about? You want to share your story? I can even book a time to have you call in and get on. You can be a guest and share your story. So why don't we start doing that? Absolutely. Let's start building that show for March, a nice support group show. That's what I would like to have in store for the March show. Thanks again all for joining us. I'll tell you, this has been a fun show, you know, between the technical things and will the guests call in? Oh, I was holding you all on, you know, the edge of your seat. I can only imagine. But I do appreciate you all. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being part of the show. The show's not for me. It's for us. And I'm sure glad to bring it to you each month. So for all of us at FSH Society and myself, take care. Have a good night. You've been listening to the FSH Society Radio Show.